Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 21st of June. This hour of the program, we're going to concentrate on state issues, and there are so many of them. Recall elections coming up, the recent Wisconsin Supreme Court decision concerning collective bargaining, the challenges to that decision, the state budget, and more. We will have two great guests with us, and I'm sure flooded phone lines. You're welcome to join the conversation at 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org. We have two guests with us. Justice Jeanine Geske is here in our Milwaukee studios, currently serving as Distinguished Professor of Law at Marquette University Law School and Director of the Law School's Restorative Justice Initiative, which is such an interesting project we talked about with her some time ago. She served as Interim Dean of Marquette Law School from 2002 to 2003, and also, this is a woman of many talents, interim Milwaukee County Executive in 2002. She was on the Wisconsin Supreme Court from 1993 to 1998, and before that, she was a Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge. She served as Chief Staff Attorney for the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee and as Clinical Director and Assistant Professor of Law at Marquette University. She has won many, many awards. In 2009, the Woman of Faith Award from the Sisters of the Divine Savior, the FBI Director's Community Award, a Wisconsin State Bar Fellows Award in recognition for contributions to the bar. In 2008, she was awarded the Wisconsin Academy of Science, Arts, and Letters, inducted into that organization, and awarded the 2007 Thurgood Marshall College Fund Legacy Award. I'm just giving you a partial list because it would take most of the show. Justice Jeanine Geske, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
We had a lot on the plate today. Steve Boss is also joining us. Steve is the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce Director of Governmental Affairs, lobbies on their behalf at the federal, state, and local levels, works with the Legislative Committee to identify and advance public policy in the interest of the MMAC members. He spent more than 16 years in government and political experience, including policy positions within Governor Tommy Thompson's administration and the Wisconsin Legislature, served as Communications Director for the Speaker of the Assembly from 97 to 2005. Steve, thank you. He is in Madison today. Hi, Steve. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's my pleasure.
Well, I'm going to start with kind of a philosophical question, weaving the second hour of the program into the first hour of the program. Second hour is on the nature principle, how we all need to get out and sit under trees and walk in the woods, and we're missing a lot in our lives if we don't do that. But the guest we will have on quotes Martin Luther King Jr. early in the book, saying that any culture will fail if it cannot paint a picture of a world that people will want to go to. And my question concerns taking that to a Wisconsin level. Please paint for us, and let's see if there we can find agreement on this, a kind of state that people will want to go to.
You want to take it first, Steve? Or?
you had the longer bio, so you probably are more qualified for it. But I'll start with that.
I think
the state everybody wants is one where there is a vibrant economy, there is a driving good job creation, good family-supporting jobs, in a context of the things we hold dear here in Wisconsin of good communities, strong schools, an appreciation for our sporting heritage and the outdoors. And I think you have a pretty vigorous debate right now about different visions of how to get to that result. But I think there is a shared vision of what we want. We want a state with a strong economy. We want a place where families and individuals are proud to be in, where they can raise a family, where they can retire, where they can enjoy all the natural beauty we have here in the context of strong communities and strong economy.
Well, that was a nice answer, Jeanine.
Yeah, I think ditto. How's that?
All right, they agree.
I would add that I think one of the things, and it will come up in our later discussions, is a place where we can have civil dialogue on difficult issues, and that we can respectfully disagree with each other on how those approaches to get to those things that Steve just mentioned, but yet we can respectfully talk to each other and explain to each other why we come from our different viewpoints, and you know, to continue to have good government and government that people can trust.
Mm-hmm. We're in a state that is so incredibly divided, and I want to ask both of you how it is. There are a lot of people who disagree with the way this state is going. There are a lot of people who wholeheartedly agree with how things are going. We look at a budget. We had completely partisan support for it and opposition to the budget. We had no Democrats agreeing. We had no Republicans dissenting from that budget. It's a government that a lot of people are not very happy with, and some are wildly happy with it. So what do you do with the people who are not very happy with all of this so they feel part of that vision that you just beautifully described, Steve?
Well, I think we have processes within our republic and within our democratic system of government to deal with people who feel aggrieved by the direction a state or a government is headed. And traditionally, that's been reflected in the orderly election process, where, you know, if you have a problem with the direction the ship's going, you vote to change that direction. I think one of the things that we're seeing new in Wisconsin this year is the effort to immediately change direction via the recall process and use that tool to undo, even almost before they're in place, the elections that were just held back in November. And that's something that it's an interesting new tactic. It'll be interesting to see how the people of Wisconsin respond to it. But I think that, you know, for our state and our nation for quite a long period of time, we've had an orderly system of changes in power, changes in philosophy that have moved along pretty successfully, and you're always going to have people aggrieved. And I think one of the reasons people are so engaged and so polarized right now is because what's being done, whether you agree with it or not, you can't argue that it's insignificant things. These are important changes, and some people who think it's headed the wrong direction, and they're significant changes, are going to react very strongly because they understand the significance of the changes. Similarly, people who agree with them are going to react very strongly in a positive way because they think it's a very good thing. But, you know, insignificant stuff, when government's involved in that, people don't get this engaged. I think people understand the significance of the changes that are being discussed, and that's why you have such engagement on both sides of the issue.
Dante Chinney, who's been on our program for years, is doing this Patchwork Nation. I'm sure both of you are familiar with this, and he's going to be spending a lot of time in Wisconsin during the recall time. He's looking at how counties are going and the changes, depending on what the county is comprised of, service workers or baby boomers or retired people. He says in a recent piece, "Will Wisconsin's recall elections hold clues to 2012? The 2011 electorate is a special animal, disgruntled and unsettled, and it would seem particularly motivated. How often, Janine, do you see 9 recalls in 1 year?"
Well, we don't. Obviously, these are very turbulent times, as was described in the Supreme Court decision. And I think it's a bringing together of a number of influences. Part of it is, I think, sort of this national view, and it occurs in different states, and it occurs at the federal level, of us demonizing the people we disagree with. And so whether it's calling people Hitler or whether it's calling people anti-freedom, you know, there's not a dialogue on these very fundamentally philosophical different views of how we ought to proceed. And I think that for a long time, Wisconsin was shielded from that because of our traditions and the way we handle things. And I think we've just got caught up in that now. And so what concerns me deeply, certainly the recall is evidence of that, but the name calling, the types of political ads that get put on, they don't go to the issues. They don't go to the difference in views. It's demonizing the other. other. And, you know, I personally hate to see that, because I think that that breaks down a philosophical debate on the merits of where we ought to be going and how we ought to go there. And I think we're going to see some very nasty ads during these recall elections.
Oh, I'm sure we are.
Instead of, you know, and, you know, I think it's I also think the recalls are unfortunate, but I think they're just a product of the kinds of turbulence and the name calling and the anger and the rage that people feel because we're not having that serious dialogue.
Why 9 recall elections, Steve?
Well, I mean, it's a strategic decision, clearly, on the behalf of the parties involved. And I don't know that you would see the recalls against Democrat candidates if there hadn't been the recall movement against Republican candidates. I think the Republicans probably felt they needed to respond in kind. But, I mean, this recall...
Well, the Republicans won, that's why.
Yeah, I think it's it's clearly part of an organized and well-coordinated strategy to try and delay changes from going into effect, to obstruct, for good or for ill, the Democrat process and make it tougher for things that you want to move forward, and in a way to deny the election outcomes of 2010 in hopes of changing them quickly in 2011. And so, I mean, I don't think it's an organic thing that all of a sudden it's sprung up, and you know, it's not like 9 people have been found guilty of dereliction of duty. It's part of a political tactic to try and turn a majority and to obstruct some changes. And we'll see how the voters respond to having that process, which traditionally had been used to deal with, you know, severe abuses of the office. We'll see. It'll be interesting to see how the voters respond to using a recall to punish someone for an individual vote that was unpopular, and it's going to be very telling, I think.
I think it's also evidence of a deep frustration that there was not any dialogue on changing collective bargaining. I know what Governor Walker ran on, and he certainly ran on budget issues and things, but he never ran on eliminating collective bargaining in the state of Wisconsin. And so I think it took people by surprise, and clearly, you know, the Republicans were in power and had the right to do it. But some of the processes were very frustrating. That's what some of the Supreme Court decision is about. But I think there was never a big dialogue or serious dialogue in the state. And so I think there's an incredible amount of frustration that didn't occur first. And I think it's popped up in a way that they think that they have got some control, which is in the recall process.
Let's go to that.
I would disagree just a little bit on the fact that there may have not been a lot of dialogue beforehand. We have seen an unprecedented level in terms of volume, amount-wise, and also volume noise-wise of the discussion of this issue. And
I
mean,
I don't disagree with that.
Very few issues that have gotten the kind of vetting that the collective bargaining changes have gotten over this contentious spring.
So, but Steve, I would have liked to see a civil dialogue and debates on it
a lot beforehand. But once it was thrown out there in the process, it certainly got a lot of discussion.
But you wouldn't argue that it was a civil debate among disagreeing parties that took time. I mean, it was a process that certainly there was a lot of vetting, and there's no question there was. And I'm not contending the state didn't know what was going on, but it was not the kind of dialogue and meeting and talking and people understanding, frankly, that I would have liked to see. But you know, it was done how it was done. But I think that's the frustration that's occurring now.
Let's go to what the governor said for the first time since the Supreme Court ruled last week. He said the Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin has been heard. I think people believe legal action is done and it is time for us to move forward. Let's go to you, Janine, on legal action. I want you to give an analysis of the decision in a moment, but is legal action is not done. Can you explain the challenges to the state Supreme Court ruling, where that all is going right now?
Well, there's what I'm going to call a smaller challenge, which I believe is a smaller challenge, and then a second challenge. The Supreme Court has ruled, and there are processes for a motion for reconsideration, which I suspect will be filed and will be substantial. I also strongly believe the result won't change. There may be differences in the opinion, depending what the court decides to do, but I think that I think the court has ruled, which means that the law can be published and go into effect. There is a federal court action that's been filed on behalf of unions, and it's a different theory. It does not go after whether or not there was a constitutional violation or how the open meetings law applied. It goes to an equal protection argument as to whether or not certain members of public unions, that is firefighters and police, can be treated differently than other public employees. And as I understand it, I have not read the pleadings, but as I understand it, the challenge is whether that's constitutional to treat different public employees on collective bargaining issues differently. And that's gone into federal court, and they're going to be asking a stay on the bill. Because they're arguing there'll be irreparable harm if it goes ahead and employment issues are decided. So that case is just beginning. But that'll be a different forum than occurred here in the state system.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that people in the state of Wisconsin, Steve, believe that legal action is done and it's time to move forward?
I don't think it matters what people in the state believe. I think we're going to see a lot of legal action. And again, it's tactical. It's a way to delay the implementation of the law. I think it's clearly organized and part of a greater strategy. I do think that there already is, and I think you may see it increasing, some conflict fatigue here. I think it's a very dangerous strategy or risky strategy for the opponents of the budget repair bill and the budget bill to continue to drag these things in court and to focus on things like recalls and that, because at a certain point they may be viewed as the ones polarizing, delaying, and causing the conflict in the state. And it goes back to what Janine said at the outset about, I think there is a desire in this state for us to be able to have civil dialogue, to disagree without being disagreeable. And one of the risks that goes along with this litigation strategy by the governor's opponents is that they will be viewed eventually as the ones being the obstructionist and being the disagreeable ones. And that carries political and public relations risks for them, even as they implement what's clearly a legal strategy.
Your analysis, both of you, let's start with you, Justice Gessie, of the state Supreme Court decision on collective bargaining.
Well, let me say at the outset, I'm not necessarily critical of the result. I don't know where I would have come out on the result. So what I'm going to talk about is more the process that was used. The case got to the Supreme Court in an unusual posture because there are a number of things that were happening. Judge Sumi initially ruled and then issued a temporary restraining order. That was appealed to the Court of Appeals. And meanwhile, no one asked for a stay, so she continued to operate and handle that case. When the Court of Appeals got it, they said there are two lines of cases that appear to be in conflict. One is cases that say that the courts keep their hands off of whether or not the legislature has followed its own rules and statutes, and another that said that the court has to take a look at whether statutes that the legislature has enacted are in conflict or consistent with a constitutional provision. And so the Court of Appeals asked for a certification, that is the Supreme Court, to handle it because they saw it as a very, very challenging issue and they thought it would go to the Supreme Court anyway. That's called a certification. What happened is while that was pending and the court didn't do anything with it, Judge Sumi continued the case and she went on and ultimately found violations of constitutional violations and statutory violations of the open meetings law, and enjoined the publication of the law, which had been stopped. There was a petition for a supervisory writ, and those of us in the law call that an extraordinary writ, extraordinary circumstances. And the allegations have to be for a supervisory writ that a judge has acted flagrantly against the Constitution and gone way outside of his or her constitutional mandates. So those two issues before the court. Now, normally, when the court gets requests, petitions of some kind, they meet privately and they decide they're taking it or not taking it. In this case, the court decided to have oral arguments on taking it. I do not remember them ever doing that before. Now, they may have, but I at least certainly with the 5 years I was there, we did not do that. And that's fine. I think these were complicated issues. I still think they're complicated issues and challenging issues. And the court took argument. Now, normally, again, the court takes 1 hour of argument on a case. It has extended that to an hour and a half and sometimes 2 hours. the arguments on whether to take the case, although people also had briefed some of the merits which relate to that issue, took 5 hours. That's the longest argument that I know of. And I did listen to about 3 hours of it. I didn't listen to all of it. And it was obvious the court, different justices were asking questions about taking the case, about whether they should, you know, the substance of the case. And I can tell you that one of the big arguments was, why doesn't the state simply appeal Judge Sumi's final order? Because the transcripts and those things are not in front of the court. They were not up there because that was not being appealed. So the court went into recess after the 5 hours and did their usual conference. Now, what I really anticipated from listening to the arguments, I believe they were going to take it. It didn't even surprise me that even though no one asked for them to take original jurisdiction, and original jurisdiction is when someone normally just files an action at the Supreme Court, and if it's big enough issue and complicated enough issue, the court can just take it. No one asked for that in this case. But from the questions, it sounded like the majority might take it as an original action, so that didn't surprise me. What I expected was they were going to announce they were taken as an original action. The next thing to find out is whether they're contested facts, because the Supreme Court can't determine facts, and it appoints a special master or it uses the transcripts from below. It did not do that. It did not tell the parties it was taken original action. It went ahead and ruled. And it ruled very quickly. It ruled within the week. The decision itself, the majority order, is only about 9 pages, I think, long, less than 10 pages long. And then there was a very long concurrence by Justice Prosser, who's the justice who replaced me on the court. And then there was a dissent by Chief Justice Abrahamson, joined by Justice Bradley and Crooks. And then Crooks wrote a concurrence. So the whole thing turns out to be 80-some pages, but the opinion itself is 9. My major concern with it is the role of the Supreme Court. The primary role is really the development of law, and explaining the law, to teaching people what applies. And the order itself is very short. It doesn't fully talk about cases. It doesn't really talk about the integration of the open meetings law as shining light on what the constitutional provision is. And the court simply ruled there's no constitutional violation. Access was not denied. And that the open meetings law, that the courts have no ability to police the legislature on open meetings law, that they set their own rules and they police themselves. And that's basically how I understand the decision. And I think it's unfortunate because it doesn't give guidance to future people, future legislators, future courts, in terms of when the constitutional provision kicks in and what it means. And so my concern is that by rushing the decision out, you know, in time for when the legislature wanted to have it, they've given up the opportunity to really explain the law for the future.
Steve, do you think they rushed it?
I think they acted in a timely manner because they understood the stakes and the timetables related to those stakes. And I will agree with Justice Geske that extraordinary action that the court took. We were pleased that they added some definition and allowed things to move forward so that you could start implementing some of these changes, hopefully. But I think the courts, the swiftness of their action was because they were cognizant of two things. One, that there was a timeliness factor and how it affected the state and the state budget. And so I think that rightly or wrongly, they took that in mind. I think also there was likely a concern that the court system was being manipulated on this issue as a tactical tool for delay on this issue. And I think that there was probably a reaction by some of the justices against being manipulated that way, and that might have given them encouragement to move swiftly to say, look, we're not going to be a pawn in your chess game. We're the court, and that's not the role that we're here to play. So I think that it was uncommon how swiftly they acted. I don't know that it was wrong or imprudent.
Let's welcome phone calls. We'll do that momentarily. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address, and we already have several emails, is talk@WPR.org. We're looking at the many issues in the state of Wisconsin, what happened recently with the state Supreme Court, the vote on the budget repair bill, recalls, which will be coming up before you know it. I want to ask both our guests, too. I mentioned this before. The New York Times did an interesting piece a couple weeks ago about what happens when there is not divided government, and it compared what's going on in Connecticut to what's going on in Wisconsin. It's like you're living in two different countries. So is it a good idea to have one body that's not the same as the executive branch or the other body? Or if you don't have any kind of divided government, do you find that a certain agenda will just be passed without the right kind of public input? So to your phone calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, the author of The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder, Richard Liu will be our guest. He wrote the international bestseller Last Child in the Woods. You may be familiar with this, and his work has been published all over the world. He's the founding chair of the Children and Nature Network, and has the book is really, really interesting because it looks at what people in mental health communities all over the world, people in schools are doing to connect people with nature, and believes that it can have a profound influence on how we learn, on how alive we are, on how we can treat illnesses, mental illness in particular. So it's inspirational. Made me want to walk around the block at least, but it was dark and kind of foggy, so I didn't do that. All right, both of you, we have tons of phone calls. Our guests this hour are talking about all of the state issues. Steve Boss, Vice President for Government Affairs at the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce, joining us by phone from Madison, where he is today. Janine Geske, Distinguished Professor of Law at Marquette University. She served on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. We start our calls with Tony in Elkhorn. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Fine. You?
I'm fine, thank you. I just wanted to add on to what Steve pointed out earlier about how these folks that are doing this court action and so on could turn out to be the bad guys in this situation. Scott Walker has become the new Sarah Palin. He appeared this morning. I don't know if anybody saw it, but he appeared this morning on CNBC, which is a liberal business channel, as the guest host. And there was the chairman and CEO of Brunswick Corporation that's moving jobs into and increasing the plant activity in Wisconsin from Oklahoma based on what Walker's activities are, and this whole end of collective bargaining, talked about the fact, and I know this personally, a young teacher who has been unable to get a job now has the ability to get a job. I think, as usual, what's being created here out of all this discourse is a celebrity. And so for all the people that dislike Scott Walker, and there's plenty of them, and, you know, they have points well taken, they've now created a new male Sarah Palin coming out of Wisconsin. This fella, if he's recalled, will probably make a hell of a lot more money, just like Palin did, not being the governor, but just simply, you know, carrying this banner that he's been carrying.
Steve.
Well, I think that...
what are you going to say?
I think the governor's star has certainly risen. But however, you know, the higher you get up in the sky, it easier is for your opponents to see and shoot at you as well. One thing that I think that Governor Walker, that even his strongest opponents would have to admit, is this guy means what he says. And I think that that is appealing to a lot of people in an era where we're increasingly cynical about politicians and we always criticize them for saying one thing and doing another. I mean, this governor has taken some bold and, in some cases, tremendously unpopular positions, staked them out, said, this is the direction I think we should be going, and he stuck to his guns in the face of incredible pressure. And I think there is some celebrity, if you will, that comes with the positions he's taking. But I think one of the things that has made him appealing and made him interesting nationally is the the fact that he's been willing to stick to his principles in the face of the atmosphere we've had here in the spring. That is uncommon in the political realm, and for better or worse. You know, if you agree with him, you know, that's heroic. If you disagree with him, it's frustrating. But this governor is unique in his willingness to state principles and stick to them. You know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead.
Justice Kesky. Is he the new Sarah Palin?
Yeah, I think that's quite a slogan. I don't know that he's going to want that on a bumper sticker. But certainly, you know, Wisconsin's become very controversial, and Scott is the governor is the head of that movement. And I know when I travel anywhere, everybody's asking about Wisconsin. So, you know, he has certainly put us on the map.
I didn't see the CNBC. I'm a radio gal, so I'm listening to at least four stations every morning, but I heard about it, so I'm sure there will be a repeat at some point. Let's go next to Glenn in Stevens Point. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to thank you for the discussion. I think it's important, especially in hearkening to what you said in the beginning about Wisconsin and the ideals and what would make people proud to be in Wisconsin. And I think the thing that is kind of missed and glossed over, especially by Mr. Basso, because being part of the Thompson administration, he recognized that he had political opponents and he had to deal with them. In this case, when he just mentioned as far as principles of Scott Walker, his principles were to take a boldly naked political move without issue, specifically focused on a group of people that he would be able to knock out of the political spectrum, weaken, and take away some of their political ability to the gain of his party. And to do it using subterfuge, making up bills to go through, I think that is something that is revolutionary. You're right. So to say it's principled, to say that you can take a political move and do it, I think that's what so many people are upset about. As far as the recalls, to say it's punishment, it's no. It's the idea that these maneuvers are going to continue, and it's not going to be a consensus building. It's going to be whatever the extreme right, or like I said, the Republican Party wants, they're going to go through, and they're looking for goalkeepers saying, we need some people who are going to say, look, we need to get to the middle of the road. So for the argument of principles, my concern, I'd like to comment on saying principles are creating a situation and a crisis to manufacture political gain without necessarily doing anything for the community. I can understand the budget concerns, you know, as far as the debt, but we're talking about surpluses coming in, and we're talking about other ways to do this. So those are my comments.
All right, Glenn, thanks for the call. Steve, you want to start?
Well, you know, this goes to something you said right before the break, Kathleen, about, you know, the nature of divided government versus unified government. And there is something ironic about the fact that when we have divided government, we have shows like this and we wring our hands over gridlock.
Right.
And when we have government all the same party, then we have shows like this and we talk about steamrolling change.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, to a degree, the nature of the beast. I think that, you know, one thing that has to be acknowledged in terms of the changes going on here is while the attention has been on the bargaining changes and the driver for that for the governor, for the administration, has been to try and create a sustainable fiscal arrangement for the state where we can have balanced budgets without tax increases, without gimmicks. And in that regard, again, for better or for worse, depending on your perspective, the budget that was passed last week and is now on the governor's desk takes a $3.6 billion deficit, eliminates it, leaves us with a surplus, and does it without any general tax increases. And one of the tools used to do that is the leverage provided by the bargaining changes in that budget repair bill. So I think it's more than a naked political power grab, as the caller suggested. I think there's some fiscal policy driving this to try and create a sustainable fiscal landscape here in the state that's conducive to economic growth.
Justice Kesky.
Well, you know, I think that it gets back to my point about having dialogue and reasoned civil dialogue on these issues, and I think that I always have felt strong. There's a reason for the balance of powers, the various, the three branches of government. And I, as much as gridlock, as Steve points out, can be a problem. On the other hand, there's also the art of compromise and dialogue and figuring out what your interests are from the various parties and trying to find a solution that works best. You know, that's why some states like Texas, you know, the legislature almost never gets together. I mean, because for fear that they're going to enact things too quickly and move too quickly. And I think that that, and whether it's Democrats are in power or the Republicans are in power, I think that that potentially is a problem. I do think, you know, these rapid changes, and I understand Governor Walker's position and why he, you know, he's proceeded the way he does. But without people having a chance, and I respectfully disagree with Steve that somehow the yelling and the leaving the state and all the things that the protesting during that time was a civil dialogue about the issue of collective bargaining. There was a lot of dialogue or at least conversation, but I don't know how much people really talked about whether there was a better way to approach this. You know, it affects a lot of people that have middle class or lower middle class incomes. And I, you know, I don't think they really had an opportunity for it to be heard and for others to listen to see if there was a better way to approach this. And it certainly didn't happen during the elections. And so I do think that that's created a problem. And it's going to take a while for us to be able to work that through as a state and try to get back to that place where we can civilly discuss, you know, how we proceed with a crisis going on that the governor and the legislature has to address.
Let's go to some emails. We have many of them. This is from Jim in Appleton. The basis for the recall elections are that Governor Walker and members of his party did not campaign on eliminating collective bargaining rights for most of public employees and making drastic cuts in funding for education. Had they announced their position on these critical items before the election, the recalls would be unnecessary. Steve?
Well, I think that's a pretty unrealistic standard to be holding any politician to, that if you didn't specifically state it in your campaign, you can't do it once you're in office. I don't believe President Obama talked about Libya when he was campaigning, and now we're at war there. So, you know, there are situations that arise, and we elect officials to exercise their judgment in that context. And, you know, the governor has put together a budget, put together a budget repair bill to implement a vision that he was very clear about on the election circuit, of creating an economic atmosphere here of balanced budgets, responsible fiscal policy with low taxes. And, you know, that he didn't itemize every last detail of how he was going to get there, I don't think necessarily needs to bind his hands or the legislature's hands as to what tools they can use to achieve the broader goal. He was very clear about his broad goals and his broad philosophy. He has presented these changes in that context of that philosophy, and I think that you know, he's been intellectually honest about the direction he's wanted to head, even if he or any particular legislator didn't detail every specific of what they had. Because, quite frankly, you get into office, you look at the numbers, and you have to work out some details on the fly sometimes.
I just want to briefly respond.
Sure.
First of all, I'm going to sound like I'm on the other side of the fence from Steve. I was appointed by two Republicans, and I agree with the conservative part of the court more than the other. So, but I do want to say this isn't like Libya, where something happened on collective bargaining well into Governor Walker's term. You know, it happened quickly. It was part of his, and it's not just an insignificant detail. You know, we have a huge history of collective bargaining issues. You know, and I understand it. I just think, you know, people did not have an understanding that that was going to be on the table, and that's why we had sort of this violent, quote-unquote, peaceful response that caused so many problems. And it was a big issue. It came early on, and I'm not saying he didn't have the right to do it. I'm just saying that's we wound up with this reaction because we didn't have the discussion on it.
Could we please spend a few moments on education? You said, Steve, when I asked you about your vision of a good Wisconsin, that strong schools were very important. Wisconsin has a reputation for having very good schools, very strong schools. A lot of the opposition, I have a lot of friends who are teachers, and I know that they are extremely concerned about the budget cuts. There are people who are losing their jobs. They're very worried, and I'm most familiar with MPS. that the classroom sizes are going to be way out of control. They're losing arts and certain languages are not going to be taught anymore. Can somebody explain why this budget does take on education in such a significant way? And it would seem to me as though there would be really bipartisan agreement that we have to educate the next generation of students, and we have to do all we can to make sure that schools continue to be top-notch. That's where a lot of the unrest is coming from when we look at collective bargaining, too. Justice Geske, would you start on this one, please?
Well, I agree, and I know because I have students working in Milwaukee Public Schools through our restorative justice work, and I work closely both with choice schools, charter schools, and MPS, and I agree with you that there's a lot of deep concern, particularly in Milwaukee, where we've had very terrible challenges, and they're complex issues on schooling, but just to have these educational cuts and what that's going to happen, and in that, putting aside the collective bargaining issue for a moment, just in terms of the kids and their access to quality education and to resources and abilities that for kids that are very, very challenged, and the majority of whom don't graduate from high school at this point. And so I am concerned about that, and I don't know where we're going to go. And I think it has to be a priority, and I assume it's a priority for the business community as well, because if we don't have a vibrant educational system, business suffers as well. So I'll let Steve address this as well.
Steve.
Well, you're right that you need a vibrant education system, but on the other hand, if money alone were the answer to a vibrant education system, we wouldn't have any problems in education in this state, because we spend more money on K-12 education than anything else in the state of Wisconsin. I think this is one of the things that you have to bring the context of the bargaining changes into when you look at how, I mean, this is a budget, a state budget to fill a $3.6 billion deficit. Everybody's going to have to figure out how to do more with less. One of the ways to do more with less in the educational front is to make sure you're prioritizing scarce dollars and getting them to education and not to superfluous things that are larded onto contracts via collective bargaining. And you see that, we saw that just recently played out in Milwaukee, where the union refuses to go in and reopen their existing contract and make some what seem like modest changes, and instead is going to force the board and the superintendent to lay off hundreds of teachers. Those are bargaining issues that have direct impacts in the classroom, and the union at MPS, MTEA, has chosen to take teachers out of the classrooms rather than budge on their collective bargaining issues in a contract that they have in place. And you've seen it all over the state, even before the court made its ruling last week, where school districts were making changes just because of the specter of the new bargaining changes out there, where they're saving hundreds of thousands of dollars, in some cases millions of dollars, by making changes within their bargaining, by requiring some contributions in, by changing health care providers to lower cost providers, all things that had not been available to them under the previous collective bargaining setups. And those things are real dollars that translate into art teachers, music teachers, you know, language teachers, reading assistants, and all those things. So you really can't separate the reforms being made in collective bargaining with the effort to allow school districts the flexibility and the ability to do more with less and to provide top-quality education even in an atmosphere of shrinking budgets.
This is an area, and, I need to speak out because I care deeply about this issue, and I'm trained to be a teacher. But it seems to me as though there's sort of this vilification of teachers, and that they're getting this really great deal, and they don't deserve it. And you hear people on other radio stations really vilifying people who teach. And it just strikes me at the core of my being, because they're people who don't make all that much money, who are working with students, who are training and inspiring the people who will take our jobs and long after we're dead, you know, that it's going to be their job. And I don't quite get it. And I think that teachers feel that they've been really hit badly here, and that is troublesome, and that's troublesome to a state. I don't understand it. Maybe you see it differently, but it seems as though there's a lot of that going on. Justice Geske, would you?
Well, I'm not pretending to be an expert on the budget and where the money goes, but I am an educator as well. I taught sixth grade and at a prior time in my life. My parents were both school teachers, public school teachers, in Cedarburg. And, I agree. I mean, I work with lots of teachers and they lead tough lives. That's a very tough
job.
And it is 10 times harder in Milwaukee public schools than it is in other places because of the complex issues that the kids have in their own lives. And you can argue about their benefits. Those have been bargained through the years. Government has given it them. They've made choices based on those things. And it's not that they shouldn't face cuts. But on the other hand, we really have to look and try to equip the schools with as much resources as we can. And I don't mean just economic resources, but resources cost money in terms of support for the disabled children, for the children who are cocaine addicted when they are born, children who have incredible both mental health issues and physical issues, and you can't do that just by not spending money on it. But we need to get these kids into a situation that they're graduating from high school and get the support. You know, I'm in favor of longer school hours. I'm in favor of a boarding school. I'm in favor of things that help get those kids into safe environments so that they can learn and that we don't have the kind of numbers we have in the city in terms of kids not going to school and not graduating.
Do you think we value teachers, Steve?
I think we do, and I think you put your finger on something really important, and it's something that teachers need to have a serious discussion about with their union and their union leadership. You know, the model of confrontation that their union has chosen is less a professional union model as a traditional labor union model, and it portrays teachers sometimes, I think, in a light that is not accurate and in a light that's more negative than it should be, and it provokes these sort of reactions from the general public. I mean, when some guy, you know, swinging a hot tar mop on a roof for, you know, $10 an hour sees teachers up in Madison complaining because they don't want to contribute anything to their health care plan, it's a negative reaction that they're going to have from their gut. It makes the teachers seem out of touch with the economic reality that's facing a lot of other hardworking people in this state. And I think it's something that the union needs to get a handle on, is how are they portraying themselves? When they have legitimate complaints about policy, how are they portraying those complaints? Are they focusing on the policy, or are they marching and provoking a negative reaction from the general public when they do it? And so I think we have a society that wants to value teachers. I think sometimes the union's own tactics are the teacher's worst enemy in terms of the public perception and the public value.
Let's welcome more phone calls. We need to pause for a moment. We just have tons of response. I'm sorry we're not getting to you as much as we should, but we have two great guests and lots to talk about. So we'll post some of these on it. Can we do that, Chrissy? We'll post some, at least the emails, on our Facebook so you can carry on a dialogue among yourselves. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to, if we can just shorten questions and responses, we can get to a few more people. Nate in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. Uh-huh. I was going to point out that there was a lack of discussion about this during the campaign, and Walker actually gave comments that specifically implied he was going to bargain harder with unions, not get rid of unions themselves or bargaining. I also wanted to say that I don't feel Walker is very principled. I feel he's an ideologue. But that does not make him principled. And if you actually look to that fake call, he was trying to trick state senators to come back who had stayed away for the point of trying to make the discussion about this an actual meaningful dialogue rather than the one side with power trying to either ignore or wait out other people without listening to them at all.
Thank you, Nate, for your call. When you think about it, he just reminds me of all that has happened in the state. It is something, isn't it, Steve? These have been incredible political times.
Well, you want to live in interesting times. You got it right now, and it is fascinating. And it's for any of you aspiring authors out there. There's books to be written off of this spring.
Jeff in Winneconne, hi.
Hi. My wife works for the state, and she was informed the other day that with the cutting of the bargaining rights, that she's going to be forced 16 hours a day and not get paid overtime. Unless she has 40 hours in a week. Now, when she's got the vacation time, a couple of days vacation, that 40 hours doesn't come up, and the vacation time is not counted as 40-hour week. So now she's going to be forced 60 hours a day and not get paid overtime. And another thing, if a person is slopping tar on top of a roof, you know, shouldn't that person be in a union? And shouldn't that person be protected by a union so that he can get better than $10 an hour? What's wrong with you, Steve?
All right. Oh, my goodness. There it is.
Yep.
People
lots
are upset.
The needle went into the red.
Yes, it did. Way into the red. Jeff, thanks very much for your call. Here's an email. Steve just said that Governor Walker managed to achieve his ends without any general tax increase. That's part of the problem. His reduction of public sector employees' compensation by 8 to 10% amounts to a selective tax increase on them. That is what is widely viewed as, at best, unfair. Steve, Anthony, we've got about 30 seconds.
That's called reframing the issue, and that's how it's reframed by some.
Yeah, I mean, where is it? Sit can determine where you stand, and welcome to the club in terms of making contributions to health insurance and things like that, seeing it come out of your paycheck. That's been happening to a lot of people in the private sector for a long time now.
Thank you both very much for being with us. I hope you'll join us again. It was a civil discussion, I thought.
Well, I think so too.
Yeah,
I think so too. It's always always great being on.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you
both very much. Thanks to Jeanine Geske, Distinguished Professor of Law at Marquette University, former member of the State Supreme Court, Steve Boss, Vice President for Government Affairs at the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce. We had many emails we never got to, so we will put those on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we'll be on these issues again. Stay tuned for the second hour if you want to be inspired. It'll be an inspirational discussion. It's a terrific book. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for on-air production, or thanks to Chrissy for on-air, Rhonda and Chrissy for producing this program, and thanks everybody for contributing on the Ideas Network.